Some of the first bees I see every year are carpenter bees. Males are aggressive, so this one flies right up to challenge my microphone. It's no worry, males don't have stingers. I set out to record peaceful garden sounds, but it's hard with all the street noise. That's the reality of my garden. I live in a busy part of town, but that doesn't mean my yard can't be a habitat. If you have even a patch of grass on your property, you can feed bees and butterflies. And this is a good time of year to start. All you have to do is not mow for a month. It's easy. You don't have to do a thing. Or do you? On this episode of Coast to Canopy, we talk No Mow March. Hi, I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas, ecology producer for WFSU Public Media. With me today to talk about No Mow March, we have Donna Laguerre. Donna and her husband Jody started Native Nurseries of Tallahassee in 1980. Donna and Jody retired from the business a few years ago, but you're still likely to see them around from time to time. Thanks for being here, Donna.
Thank you.
And we have also Mark Tansig. Mark is the Horticulture Extension Agent for the University of Florida, IFAS, Leon County Extension. Thanks for coming in, Mark.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and finally, we have my colleague, Regan McCarthy. Regan is the Assistant News Director for WFSU-FM, and I'm told she's a bee whisperer.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for letting me join you today.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Yeah, so I want to start with, we were talking about No Mow March. So in North Florida, why is it March? Why isn't it No Mow May?
Good question. So it was a group of horticulture agents that I brought this up to them, this idea. And really it came from an extension client who sent me the No Mow May, a newspaper article from the New York Times, these beautiful pictures, and said, hey, what about we tried something like this in Tallahassee? And so I got with some of these other extension agents. We kind of chatted about it. And No Mow May, first of all, would be a little intense as far as you've seen the biomass. You know, plants grow in May in Florida. It's a little bit different than Wisconsin, I think, where I got the original article. And so March seemed more doable. And the other thing about why we do it in March is that's when our pollinators are kind of coming out of their little winter slumber, and they're looking for food, right? And oftentimes it's those weeds mixed in our lawn that are going to really help them get some resources as they're kind of coming out of their winter little sleepiness.
Gotcha. And I'm glad you brought that up. So, I mean, also not disturbing the lawn at that time is probably beneficial for them as well as far as their nesting habitat or nesting habits. And
so No Mow May, that's something that happens like around the country right now?
Well,
and we're thinking March just makes more sense here in North Florida.
Yeah, so No Mow May is an effort that I've seen. I think it was Wisconsin that they promoted it, and I think a couple other folks up north, it was No Mow May. Remember in March, there's still like snow on the ground in some of these places.
Right. So wind chill in New York is 23 today. I saw that in the New York Times, so they're not worrying about their lawn weeds right now.
And so and it makes sense for them, both the growth of the plants, and that's when their pollinators are coming out of their little winter sleepy time.
And in preparation for this, I decided today to look up where did this No Mow come from. And it started in England, in the UK. And then it was picked up by Bee City, USA, and they made it into No Mow May. So I'm glad to hear how we got No Mow March, which makes sense to me, too.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just, I knew May wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And No Mow April doesn't sound right, and it's still a little bit much. But No Mow March has a nice ring to it. It's also a time, my own yard, I have skipped mowing in March before, and it's doable.
Yeah.
And you do get all these, like, great kind of, you know, mostly winter annual. Most folks would call them weeds, but, you know, the idea is to get them to think of these things as wildflowers and resources instead.
Yeah, so what kind of things are we seeing? I think a lot of us are already seeing them as we drive around town. And, you know, what kind of wildflowers are we talking about here?
I haven't really seen that many in the lawn yet, but they're coming.
Yeah,
I think what we'll expect are lyreleaf sage, little bluets, the little white wildflower that's almost right on the ground. Some little yellow clovers, blue-eyed grass. Those are some of the ones that we'll see, but they're not quite up yet. But going back to what you were saying about the little pollinators and the minor bees that are, you know, need these no-mow areas. When on my walk just yesterday, I passed a house where all along the roadside at the corner were all these little piles made by the little minor bees. And if they were to mow that, they'd be smashing it down. So to have that good habitat as well as the flowers.
Oh, what are the minor bees collecting? Tell me more about that.
Well, the minor bees are little pollinators that come up out of the ground. They're, what would you call them, single?
They're solitary nesters. Yeah.
Solitary nesters, that's what word I was looking for. But the ones that I was looking at, they nest in a colony, even though they're solitary nesters. So each one digs down, and when she lays her eggs down in there, she has little chambers, and she'll have a few eggs down there, but not like a yellow jacket nest where you'd have thousands and thousands. And so they're relatively, they're very docile. You can get up right close to them and watch them and not be worried about them. But the problem is that when people see them in their yards and they see these little bees, sometimes the males will get up over the colony and they'll buzz around like this, you know, looking for females to mate with. People get alarmed, and then they'll call the exterminator or they'll do something to get rid of them, poison them. So.
Interestingly, I've always been told that it's important to leave like some bare soil in your gardens for places you plant. And I know one of those reasons maybe has to do with butterflies, but it sounds like also our pollinator friends, the bees, need some of that bare soil space.
Yeah, we have a lot of native solitary bees that are ground nesting. And so they need that little patches here and there. We don't want too much bare ground to cause erosion, but, you know, little patchy places, little thin grass. You know, are perfect for them to do their little burrows.
Wow!
Next to the station, we actually had a bunch of mining bees pop up last year. I've been keeping an eye out, and I haven't seen that yet. But these little mounds—they look kind of like ant mounds, but the hole is a little too big for an ant. You know,
so we need to tell our FSU facilities folks about No Mow March.
We've started to get calls about these digger bees, and sometimes it's too late where they've already called the pest control company, and we're told that we can take care of those for you. But we try to get them to. You know, some folks might be allergic to bees, and it, you know, no matter what, you know, we can try to convince them they're going to want to get rid of them. But we do try to get folks to consider that they're just going to be there for a little bit, you know, just kind of, if you can, just tolerate it for a little longer, because then the rest of the year they're just down in the ground and they're not around, you know, potentially disturbing us.
And solitary nesters tend to be docile. It's the hive kind of, you know, they have a worker class, you know, like honeybees or like paper wasps or yellow jackets are a really bad one.
But I did want to add a couple other wildflowers that you might start to see. So right now, and one that started for me to get me to leave chunks of the yard unmowed was our violet. So we have these violets coming up, and they're really abundant. Right now there's a lot of vetch. So
I have a lot of that.
There's some vetch. Not all the vetch species are going to be native. But they're not considered an invasive species. They're just kind of like in our disturbed areas, but they're really important for bees. You have your Carolina geranium, which is that's a native species, often considered just kind of a weed in the lawn. But it's a native that's blooming this time of year, really good for the pollinators. Let's see, a little bit later on in March, if you're really lucky, you'll get things like Spiranthes orchids come up in your lawn, which is really, you know, I love to see those pop up because they're just really, really pretty little orchids that come up in a spiral. You know, the idea, again, is to get folks considering what they're seeing out there as wildflowers and to encourage them to get out there and identify them and learn what they are. So folks that want like the perfect lawn, No Mow March may not be for them, but what we want them to see is like maybe there's a little side yard or back piece of the backyard that you could leave unmowed. Again, just to kind of excite some curiosity and like what might come up in my yard and what is it and is anything visiting it trying to get resources.
And for people that want a more natural lawn, but they still want a lawn, after these plants go to seed, you just mow them down. And it just looks like the lawn again. It's just green from a distance. When you get up close, those violet leaves are still going to be there. The lyreleaf sage leaves are going to be there. So, you know, up close, it will look like a green mass.
But when you drive by, it looks just like a lawn.
Right.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
So that's so timing. So when does, you know, I notice my lawn, there's some of those flowers will persist, you know, into April a little bit. So when is the time to end? When it goes to seed? Is that...
Yeah, I'd watch for the seed, I think, because it could vary from yard to yard. Like I said, most of my stuff isn't blooming yet. Now, the violets are. Mm-hmm. My whole backyard is violets.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It is really pretty right now.
Yeah. When does it – I mean, it kind of depends on how tolerant you are, right? So this is all – people have their own ideas of what they're willing to deal with aesthetic-wise in their landscape. And some folks are okay with having a little craziness. And in that case, go all the way to No-Mo May if you want to. But otherwise, you know, the thing is, after March, a lot of our other landscape plants, a lot of other native species just out in the landscape are up and they're blooming and they're flowering. And so then these pollinators have a chance to go find resources in other places. It's that little window where most things are still dormant, where we have these winter annuals kind of finishing off, where they could it could help out the pollinators a little bit.
Yeah. And then, Donna, you were talking earlier when you first got here about just when you do this over time, and you noticed in the property next to native nurseries that over time, like, what happened when you did this kind of No-Mo spring, you know, over years?
Right. Well, first of all, it was my mother-in-law that did it. And it was back in the 1980s. It was when my children were young. They were toddlers, late 80s. And she had this fairly large centipede lawn, no fertilizing and no watering. But it just grew, just, you know, almost like it was native, but it's not native. And she noticed these few flowers popping up. And so she would leave them up. And over time, this patch got larger and larger. And it was so prolific that she would tell the kids to go out and pick as many as you want. And for her, she wasn't so much thinking of pollinators. She was thinking about children in the field picking flowers.
Yeah.
And then after our kids grew up, she would come over to the nursery and say, oh, to a family, oh, bring your kids over and have them pick the wildflowers. But in the meantime, pollinators were using it too. So then, as I mentioned, she would mow it down after the plants went to seed. But it got larger and larger, and it's still there today. So I my son then managed it when he lived in the house, and he noticed that blue-eyed grass was out there. And again, we didn't plant it. It just popped up, and he continued that mowing regime. So hopefully it'll be there forever.
Yeah, and then, yeah, as far, you know, with extension, I'm here to, you know, I have to provide the science-based information. And there are actually scientific articles, and I can share those with you, Rob. You can check them out a little bit more. And one of them even called it the lazy lawnmower approach. And these articles were looking to see, or these researchers were looking to see if, you know, how can we encourage more biomass and more diversity in urban landscapes, right? So as more and more of the country becomes urbanized, you have a lot more of these, you know, urbanized, you know, landscapes that us humans are in charge of maintaining. And how can we maintain them in a way that still supports lots of biodiversity? They looked at this lazy lawnmower approach and found that you don't really have to go in and do a whole lot of stuff. You just have to take a break from mowing so often. And so it was great. It went right into No-Mow March and now, you know, just be a lazy lawnmower.
That's a great segue into the next thing I kind of wanted to talk about, which is, so maybe people have a space and they're thinking more kind of long-term, you know, maybe rewilding a space a little bit. And so when you do that, what effects over time? I know, I guess in our yard, we did it a little bit. We lost an oak tree in a storm, and just over time, I noticed beauty berries started coming. So I have shrubs, so beauty berries and pokeweed and salt bush. How do you manage that differently than No-Mo March?
I've got a good one on that. When my daughter was between undergraduate school and veterinary medicine school, she lived and worked at the nursery for a bit. She lived in the house, in grandma's old house. And there was a big lawn out front. And she said, oh, I'm going to take part of this and just do a pollinator patch. And I'm just going to mow it once a year. And so she just figured out, and it was out in the sun, so it was a sunny area. And that was over 20 years ago. And it's still there. Uh-huh. And we do mow it once a year. Sometimes it gets burned, actually.
All right.
But,
yeah.
But it, and
I think they were trying that Saturday, actually.
Yeah. Right. So what she noticed, she also had some chickens, so free range chickens. They were constantly in the area because it was full of insects.
Yeah.
And not just pollinators, all sorts of insects. And then when we started teaching workshops for children at the nursery about, you know, insects, we had a field element to it, and they'd come with nets and they'd scoop, and they could get into that patch and find all sorts of things in there. So it was very, very productive. It is very, very productive. But the problems you run into is that when you're only mowing once a year, is that you'll get trees, and native and non-native, and the trees would shade it out eventually and shade out the wildflowers. So sometimes we have to go in and dig out some of the trees. But the worst thing we've had are invasive vines like skunk vine that moves through the grass and can actually get into a bed like that. So there's work involved. When you make a natural area, you have to watch for the invasive plants.
Yeah, this is an issue that, you know, say a homeowners association has common area or even city parks, right? I mean, we see them as wild spaces, but to kind of keep those biodiversity, you know, those like benefits there for, you know, all these good creatures, you do have to do some maintenance. You can't really just let it go and expect it to be wild, because Florida's natural ecosystems, there was things that kept those in check, mostly fire, like mm-hmm. Donna just mentioned. We're not all going to be burning our landscapes because it's not always very safe. But what we can do is you're going to have to get in there and somehow mimic a fire. So like Donna said, if you leave it too long, trees, shrubs are going to come in. They'll start shading things out. Pine trees have come in my areas pretty thick. And so you do have to go in there and thin them out and maybe mow it down once a year, twice a year maybe, just to kind of keep it a little bit in check, because otherwise it just goes wild. You get invasive plants come in, and then you wonder, you know, should we have just kept mowing this, you know?
One thing that I've heard, though, is that if you really focus on purposefully putting native plants mm-hmm. into those spaces, then that can help to battle those invasive plants, right? Because our native plants are meant to grow here, and they're going to do well here. And if we can get them to sort of take over the spot, it can sometimes keep those.
Yeah, I mean, the problem
not
with
so
our
much,
not
it
so
looks
much
like.
Because our invasive species are just, you know, they're in an environment where there's no checks on their growth. Mm-hmm. And so they can just really, you know, many of them are able to outcompete these native plants.
They can grow, some of them can grow faster, and they're not eaten by anything else.
Interesting.
Right. And I've been working at McCord Park as a volunteer for over 20 years, which is a little park in Benton Hills.
Yeah.
And it's a natural park. There's no swings or anything like that. It's like for walking through or bicycling or whatever. We've been fighting invasive plants there all these years, but we still want to keep adding diversity, so we keep planting too. And we've been working with the city on one area that was just so full of invasives, we just couldn't keep up with getting them out of there. So we worked out a plan with them for them to mow in between the big trees, because this was a forest, 3 times a year. And that's working pretty well. Mm-hmm. And in between the 3 mows, you get some growth. And then our crew comes in around the big trees where the mowers can't get, and we get those invasives out by hand. And that's working. But again, that mower can be your friend. And I would think, I haven't seen any little colonies of bees in there. But I would think it would be a good spot, because it's, the ground is loose, and but I haven't really seen any there.
Right. So if you're just getting started in this, and you have a space and you kind of want to try out a little rewilding, what's a good way to learn, or what tools can you use to learn what's, you know, the native stuff, and what's the non-native naturalized stuff, and what's the really bad invasive stuff that comes in?
I would say one of the things you can do is go to a natural area near you, and not necessarily a local park, but like go to the forest and see what these areas, what they look like when natural functions happen, right? So fire, native species, you know, thick native species, kind of look and see what that looks like, and go back and say, okay, this is what I'm going to try to do in my area. And then you have to look and observe. There's lots of observation that needs to go on, right? So document things. You can use things like iNaturalist or Seek, these little apps that help you identify plants. You can contact your local extension office, and we'll help you ID things. But just I would say look and see what that natural area is actually supposed to look like. Try to recreate that in your little patch, and then just observe what's coming up. If it's native, leave it alone. If it's not, you know, try to weed it out of there.
I think that's such a cool idea. But like if I'm trying to do that at my house, should I be looking at a woodlands, at a grasslands, at a, like how do I know based on what I have in my yard, what I should be observing to try to copy?
Well, I think a woodland is going to be easier just because when you got the shade, you don't have so many weeds coming in. And this goes back to those pollinators too. Don't always think about just little wildflowers being your plants for pollinators. The trees are great too. So right now in my yard, there's a Flatwoods plum blooming.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that gets pollinators on it. Or Chickasaw plum is starting to bloom right now. Redbud will be blooming. I think it's blooming now too. So trees can do it too. You don't have to have just the wildflowers. But if you're starting off in a woodland area, I would learn what are invasive plants. And you can do that by going to the extension office. You can come to Native Nurseries with a cutting and have somebody on the staff identify it, because I think we know pretty much all those invasives. And so you want to work on getting rid of those. And then since you already have, like, say, large trees and you might have a smaller tree or a shrub, just by stopping mowing, certain things will move in. Like he had American Beauty berries move in. You can buy an American Beauty berry, but usually the birds will plant it for you. And pokeweed, I think that's a great plant. You'd never be able to buy one because it's a dime a dozen. But a bird will plant it. And so just by not mowing underneath your trees, you've made a seed bed where things are going to come in. And then you could go to a nursery and pick out things that would be shade tolerant and just talk to people and say, you know, this is what I have. It's shady and I want a shrub or I want wildflowers on the ground. Like right now I've got woodland phlox blooming in my yard. Mm. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's really pretty.
I think, Regan, something else you could try. I mean, there might be little pieces within your neighborhood that maybe have a little piece of that naturalness left. And so that can help you get an idea. So, you know, I lived in Levy Park for a while, and it was pretty built out. But there was right around Rudiger, there's a little patch of what used to be, right? So there's some big shortleaf pine. There's some big hickories, so mockernut hickories out there. So that gives you an idea, you know, like a red oak hickory woods type of an idea. And so I would say visit some of the greenways, learn some of the plants out there, and then see what's coming up around, you know, go on a walk around the neighborhood, see what's popping up in more of the, you know, the places that are left alone a little bit to try to get a little hint of what might have been there. So if you see magnolias and beech trees, maybe you're more in like a woodland situation. If you're close to a stream, you're going to be more in a little beech magnolia forest where, you know, if you're up at the top of the hill, it probably would have been a, you know, pine open forest there.
Yeah, interesting. That's really cool.
And I've actually worked with Native Nurseries. We did a workshop on planting for your natural ecosystem at your yard, and we actually showed all the plants that they had, which one were like a pine flatwoods, which one was like a little beech magnolia forest, and it was a really fun little workshop.
Sounds fun.
Very cool.
So yeah, you know, we want to mimic as much as we can these natural ecosystems, but we're still in this really artificial kind of area. So, you know, how much can we expect to reach something like what was there before?
Well, we're not helping by mowing it all down every week. So if we just start with little patches, and maybe our patches get bigger, maybe more of your neighbors add a little patch, you know, mm-hmm. It kind of goes to this idea Doug Ptolemy talks about in his books of, you know, thinking of your yard as a potential wildlife preserve. And if more of your neighbors start to do it, then it kind of, you have more patches for the little, like Frogger, for these little animals right. To kind of make their way around the landscape.
And I think also one of the most important things is to use very little in the way of pesticides, both herbicides and insecticides. They're way overused, at least in my neighborhood. I think it affects my yard as well. It's coming down from, you know, from uphill.
Right.
You know, we're trying to increase the diversity of insects in our yard.
And it's not just pollinators, right? So
no.
We increase the number of insects because we want to feed, mm-hmm. you know, birds
right.
and everything else. I mean,
right.
You said Doug Ptolemy, that's a big
thing.
Yeah.
And with the pesticides, you know, a lot of folks don't realize that, you know, they might want to get the sod webworms out of their yard. They might want to deal with some lawn pest. But a lot of our pesticides that we use on those insects are not specific to those pests. You know, they knock out a lot of things, and a lot of things that are just causing no harm and just living in the soil as larvae. So those digger bees we talked about at the beginning, you know, firefly larvae, there's all kinds of larvae that are just hanging out doing no harm. And when we apply these products, thinking we need to start thinking that it's not just the pest that I'm concerned about that these are harming, but it's a whole lot of other insects as well.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Doug Tellamy. I think he has a really cool thing about everyone can make like a little piece of a national park in their yard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a cool concept. And I don't have a very big yard, you know. I just live in a little space, just a little yard, but I can plant a few things. And I try to keep the percentage of native plants higher than the percentage of not native plants. Mm-hmm. And I feel like just with that, you know, with a small little space, I can participate in being part of that. You know, everybody's building a national park in their yard. So I just love how accessible that is for every person. Yeah. I mean, even maybe if you live in an apartment and you've got a few potted native plants on your balcony, I think that's your national park.
Mm-hmm. Right. What you plant makes a difference. Before we close, I wanted to put a plug in for the Southeastern blueberry bee, which is a
I haven't heard of this one.
It's the same as the Florida blueberry bee, the digger bee. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
They're up now. They're digger bees, and they're up now. What's interesting about that bee is that it looks like a little bumblebee, but it's much faster, and it's only out during the season that blueberry plants bloom. That would be sparkleberries, huckleberries, all the different blueberries. Now, it'll go on other plants that are out at that time, so you'll have it on a red bud. And other plants. But I love having blueberry bushes. And without this blueberry bee, there's a few other pollinators that'll use it, but it's a primary pollinator. You just wouldn't have the blueberry crop that we have. What people need to learn is that blueberry bee is a digger, a miner bee, and it mines down into the ground. So there again, I don't know that it goes in a colony, though.
No,
and
it's
solitary by itself, but I mean,
you see a few of them at a time.
Yeah,
in my yard, I see
but nothing
at least three
like
or four.
Huge,
yeah.
Like the other minor bees that we were talking about earlier. Yeah. So that always excites me when I see those.
Yeah, it's another bees.
They move quickly.
You know, another example of one that spends most of the life cycle is just hanging out in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, with these other products that we might be using, you know, really can affect these kinds of species.
Right. And I feel like that's such a good example, too, about like one of the questions we ask ourselves in journalism is why should people care, right? Why do people care about this? And so we all care because we think bees are cool, but maybe not everybody does. And so why should they care? Well, they should care because these bees are important for helping to make it so that we have delicious blueberries to eat, or they're important to helping, you know, grow our other crops, or just bugs in general, the bugs that come from our native plants, give us the beautiful birds we like to look at. And so I think that's an important just kind of perspective to sometimes put in our brains.
Definitely. And I think, too, just looking at your own happiness, you know, it brings me joy to see this. And I think when you show that to other people, they get it and they get interested in it. So I think that's why this program is good.
Yeah.
Getting the word out.
Well, I appreciate you coming in. And, you know, in my yard, you know, the blueberry diggers, almost like Florida betony, which is a native weed that grows on your lawn, that some people just really hate.
Native wildflower.
But they love, but the blueberry, they like it. Maybe I only have a handful of bushes, but they love the betony. And so on that note, this is a great talk. Thank you guys so much for coming in. Don Laguerre, Mark Tanzig, Regan McCarthy, and I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.